Hello, welcome to Outrageous, a weekly podcast where we talk about culture, media, race, politics, and everything in between. My name is Chris. I'm in New York City, and usually I am joined by my two very best friends, Jason in Washington, D.C., and Trisha in L.A. Unfortunately, this week we could not get our stuff together to record a new podcast. So we recorded several episodes last year when we were practicing to make this podcast a reality. And so I've gone back in the archives and pulled some interesting conversations that Jason, Trisha, and I have, and I present them now to you. Keep in mind that what you're about to hear was recorded in the summer of 2015, so I apologize in advance for any outdated references. Without any further ado,
probably over dramatic reaction from the other two, and I'm really looking forward to it. I think we got some good stuff to talk about, and I think, Trisha, you should go first.
No, mine is a mellow topic, remember? So mine should stick in the middle.
Mine's kind of mellow, too. How about Jason? Okay. Jason, you're always overbearing and heavy. What's your
Exactly.
I'm going to do a solo podcast called Overbearing and Heavy.
That's great. Oh, I like that.
All right. I've thought a lot about how to pose this. I'm just going to pose it this way. So my humble suggestion to Black American elites, and by elites I mean people who have some substantial amount of capital, social capital, financial capital, to start in a place where there's already a good concentration of Black intelligentsia, let's say Atlanta, and start to put in infrastructure to kind of build out a Black American state, like its own state, not just like the 50 states. And gradually start to invite Black Americans with less capital to come live, and gradually over time, I think it's got to be gradual, build out to the point where there is a true Black American or a true Black state on the North American continent, rather than the current approach, if one could call it that, of kind of a diaspora within this country. There are so many challenges already to, you know, advancement on a mass scale and true equality in this country, that I really wonder whether the approach instead should be a geographic density, a geographic concentration, very deliberate, very careful building infrastructure over time. If we think about the different strategies for trying to improve the challenges facing Black Americans, like discrimination, income inequality, incarceration, and we could come up with lots and lots, worse health outcomes, all the disproportionately negative things affecting Black Americans, my question is, shouldn't a strategy be considered that would actually involve geographic density and some deliberate kind of carving out of a place that's governed by Black leaders with Black capital?
I think the thing that's most useful about your scenario is the introduction of the word deliberate, because we accidentally have these all the time, right? You know, we have, like, even places where we've had problems, like in St. Louis, where Mike Brown was killed. Overwhelmingly, that population was Black, but the leadership was white. In other places, we have overwhelmingly Black population, like, say, Baltimore, but the leadership is Black. So I think the question is, how do we approach constructing communities in a more mindful way so that we actually explicitly talk about maybe the things that we always bring up here, which is we explicitly talk about white supremacy and how to sort of remove those things from the actual, from the process. But because we've done that, we have cities that are geographically one way and we haven't seen any difference. So it's the deliberate nature that you are advocating, right?
That's right. Exactly.
My question is, to what end? Like, to Trisha's point, there certainly are cities where there are majority Black people with Black leadership. There's geographic density. Deliberate versus not deliberate, my question is, what is the goal here? The goal is to encourage Black success economically or politically? Like, to what end would this happen?
Yes, that's the goal.
That's the goal. What's the vision? So the vision would be like in some near future where what? I don't feel like I'm not really grasping this.
Well, I think in some ways though, Jason, the question of whether it's actually about I mean, I think we have to go on a system. We have to think systematically. We have to approach this problem as a structural systemic issue. And so when you talk about sort of moving into a particular arena, in some ways you have to kind of wipe the slate clean and create brand new structures. It's not about moving people into a certain area or approaching the laws with suddenly a black face. That's obviously not the right solution.
Well, that's right. And I think, you know, I mean, you mentioned Baltimore. Baltimore is a lot of what's driving me to think about this. I've thought about it before recent events, but, you know, Baltimore, as you said, it's predominantly black in terms of the people who live in the city. The political leadership is predominantly black, but mm-hmm. they are operating within structures that were created, you know, not only when white people were in power, but some structures that were created with the deliberate kind of end of, you know, either subjugating black people or enforcing segregation, controlling black bodies. And, you know, right now it's like, I feel like with recent events in Baltimore, a lot of the dialogue's been, oh, well, wow, you can have a black mayor and a yep. black police commissioner and still have these problems. And then what I hear from people, which, and I'm going to say, I don't think this is a bad idea, I'm not arguing with it, but some people are saying, yeah, but you still don't have people from the communities where a lot of the policing is happening on the police force. So, okay, let's try to do that. Now, that in itself, I think, will take a long time, a lot of money, and be very difficult. But let's say we could wave a magic wand and do that. I'm still not convinced because, again, the roots of law enforcement in this country, many of them, are in white supremacy, subjugation of black people, fugitive slave law, and I know that was a long time ago, but not so long ago, you had police officers, part of their job description, you know, keeping down black protests, and, you know, now with the war on drugs, we have law enforcement whose jobs it is in many ways to stop and frisk and disproportionately profile black people. So with all that in mind, that's exactly right. Like, if someone doesn't kind of start new structures, then I'm very skeptical, unfortunately, about our ability to extricate our current structures from policies and practices that perpetuate white supremacy, even if no one wants that. I feel like it's in the DNA.
So your vision of like a black-led, black-majority, black state, I mean, we're talking about some sort of black Atlantis, Blacklantis, if you will. While that sounds really great, it doesn't really combat the things that you're talking about right now, Jason. Like white supremacy is the problem. That's the basis on which the country is built. So even if we got black intelligentsia and we got like a density of like black people who are creating economic opportunities for other black people and pulling them in, like I'm not certain that that would actually affect things. Unless we're talking about then some sort of secession of those people from the United States of America, which I don't yep. think that's where you're going, but I think
no.
that's
where you're going. Oh, no, I am going there.
Oh, you are? That's where you're going?
I wouldn't use it. That was his punchline. I don't know if I would use the term secession,
maybe. A straight-up black Atlantis, like we all move to the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, so, I mean, all right, once you add the secessionist piece to it, then it makes a lot more sense. I just don't think you can have an experiment within an experiment. I can't quite see that. I mean, we've attempted things like that in terms of like intentional communities that are overwhelmingly sort of white, and then they kind of are about co-op like in nature, sharing of land and sharing of property and food and co-sharing, co-parenting, and those kinds of things. Which I actually probably be more interested in that than any kind of sort of mass exodus, because first of all, nobody wants to go leave anywhere, because hello, folks built this place, so why should we have to leave? but I would rather see intentional communities prop up all over cities in the United States.
Well, when you say intentional communities, though, Trish, you're mm-hmm. talking about something different with Jason. You're talking about intentional communities which alleviate some social pressures and problems that we have.
Yes.
Jason's talking about alleviating political, economic, and legal problems that we have as a result of white supremacy. And
yeah, which means you have to leave the system.
That's what I'm saying. So, I mean, Jason, it's an interesting thought experiment, and I've been struggling to remember this. Like, someone has tried this in history. There was a
Marcus
Exodus.
Garvey.
Yes, that's it. Right, it's Marcus Garvey. That's
Marcus Garvey. Yeah, and I think
Ill-planned, ill-executed.
Ill-conceived, really.
Well, I mean, it's difficult, right? Because you need... I mean, I guess Jason also raises the issue around, like, capital. You need the sort of quote-unquote black intelligentsia to buy into this.
And to lead it. Not just buy in, but to lead it. And
they rarely do, because usually they're at the top of the heap.
It's an interesting thought experiment. But there's no handhold on it, I think, for us to apply anything we would learn from that thought experiment to our current situation. Because we have to change the underpinnings of the country, which I think is a worthwhile conversation. But I don't know if this particular experiment would get us there.
Isn't that Liberia? I mean, ultimately, I think that was Liberia.
I was going to say, it's Liberia capital. Right. It's Liberia
with capital. That is the challenge. That is the difference, though. The key difference is with capital, because this is the challenge of leaving a capitalist society for the black intelligentsia, is that they happen to be at the 1%, and they don't leave a successful system at all. Or who's to say that they will leave and not replicate the system of oppression that they've just left, because they're the 1%, right?
So why not we should all just invest in Liberia then, no? I mean, it's over there.
But we've
You laugh, but I'm being serious, right?
Yeah, but see, we returned.
No, but no, so
Jason raised last
but
week.
Let me just. I realize this is somewhat of a fantasy, but let's just say for a second that Black Atlanta became the capital, and like Georgia was this place. Let's just say that for a second. I think the benefit of that is you have a lot of black capital there that is tied in. Like you have, for lack of a better term, trade relationships ready to go. Like, in terms of interacting economically from state to state, meaning Georgia to the rest of the United States, like, you actually have the opportunity to continue to build capital in the way that countries do, you know, in terms of trading and that kind of thing. Going to Liberia, I mean, I think we would all agree, like, there's so little infrastructure compared to what there is here among the black intelligentsia that I have a lot more faith in the – I mean, again, I know it's fantasy, but I have a lot more faith in the ability for it to be successful here at least first than in Liberia.
But Liberia is reality, and your Black Atlantis is a fantasy in the sense that, you know, we can't use the infrastructure of a system that is keeping us down. Like, this is not going to work. We laughed before, but really, if the black intelligentsia wanted to invest in Liberia – that would actually make more sense. That is a country, that is an area, we could actually do that. We are not claiming any part of this country and making any sort of, like, you know, new Shangri-La. It's just not going to happen. So, yeah. Are we ready to leave that there? Do you have anything you want to add to that, Trish?
Well, I don't know. I feel like Jason should add something to it. I feel like his topic didn't get his due. I don't know
Let's reflect on your experience here, Jason. What did you think of what we said? Like, how did that hit you? Is that what you were looking for?
I thought it was an interesting conversation. I still would love to see happen what I suggested, but I also recognize it's very likely.
I mean, I'd like to see flying monkeys, but, like, I mean, what am I going to do about that?
I would not like to see flying monkeys, just for the record. That would scare the hell out of me.
Oh, no.
I'd be into it.
Why would you be there?
You could ride them around.
Really? You see people ride monkeys? I mean, why don't you ride them when they're walking on the ground then? I feel like that would be some scary shit. Have you seen The Wizard of Oz? They're scary when they fly.
I don't know. Anyway.
Well, thank you two for indulging me in
that another
fantasy.
One of your crackpot hippie fantasies, yeah. Anytime, Jason, anytime. I'm just gonna transition directly into mine then. And the question I want to pose is, why college? Why is college happening? Why is that a societal thing? Now, college education or education for people who are 18 to 22, for my topic, let's accept that's a given. My question is, why are we sequestering people in the late teens, the people who have the worst impulse control and are not fully formed adults? Why do we put them in sort of this conclave where a lot of bad things happen in national news? You know, frat racism is a problem, sexual assault on colleges is a problem, and none of those things are really handled in a satisfactory way as far as I'm concerned. You know, every time that every time that a woman is sexually assaulted on a college campus and we hear about it, there's always, you know, the Title IX investigation show, the school looked at it and decided that there was no wrongdoing. And I'm always like, why, what? Like, how are the police not involved? Like, why is there a secondary system that we have to push people through for justice? And that's kind of weird. But not even justice, just discipline. And why should the school should be disciplining people? Oh, you shouldn't have raped that girl. Take a semester off. Oh, man, like, what? I don't know of any other, there's no other part of society that we sort of wall off in that way. So I was just, that's my question for you. Like, so I don't know who wants to start, but Tricia, why college? Why are we doing this? Why does it persist?
Well, I mean, I think we're doing it because we've always done it that way. I'll be
honest.
Oh
my God.
I mean, that sounds really horrible, but I think that's what it is. I think we've always done it that way. And I think it comes out of the sort of, English tradition, you know, the send the school away and connect and families, and I have no idea what that the original intention of that is, but I think realistically it's just inertia. We've always done it that way. But I do think that there will come a time, whether it be sort of technological push, that that pushes back on that, right? That pushes back on this larger question of, hey, maybe I don't need to send my kid away to college. Maybe my kid can just stay here. It'll probably be a financial issue. That's probably the reason. But it's strange because when you're asking this question, I'm fully reminded, it's almost as if college is the experiment that Jason's talking about.
Oh?
Because think about, I mean, that's really what it is, right? These are intentional communities with their own internal rules, and they exist outside sometimes of society structure, right? Because if a girl is raped in her apartment, you assume the cops will come by and they'll investigate, blah, blah, blah. But if it happens on a college dorm, all sorts of different rules apply. So in a strange way, a college environment is actually this very, very much living experiment. And so the question, I guess, for me is why have we decided that we wanted to create a living experiment within the U.S.? For this population.
But thousands of them. Thousands of them all over the country operating for economic gain, which is...
I think that's the problem with it, too. And I think that's actually what ultimately will cause it to change and disband, is that I think the economic motive no longer makes sense, right? Because I think there's really this push now towards the idea of college being the next step for public education, right? That should be free. And I guess I would assume that that's going to be the big challenge in like the next 50 to 100 years. And why would you then send kids away for that? Maybe not.
Yeah, so it's interesting how it's interesting the thread you mentioned, Tricia, as what joins our previous conversation with this one. The one I was thinking about was capital. Because, you know, that's, I think a lot of this, a lot of your question, Chris, a lot of the different parts of it have to do with capital. I mean, first of all, I think this is, like so many other things, this is an institution that evolved, you know, from a time that I think it made a lot of sense. Now, when I say that, made a lot of sense for the wealthiest, you know, whitest, most WASPy people in the world, but it made a lot of sense for them, for a very small portion of the population, you know, all men, of course. And now, you know, so it starts there, and this is how the wealthy elite, you know, their kids get educated to take over their businesses, to start new businesses, to build relationships that they can then leverage to build businesses with each other, as well as to, you know, compete with each other, all of those things. And then, you know, the thing that I think that great paradox about our country is, on the one hand, it's a country that is really started in order to help a small wealthy elite stay wealthy or be even wealthier, not have their money siphoned off to England. But because the rhetoric behind that and the ideas behind that have to do with equality, then there's this always, well, let's at least make it possible in some small way for the rest of the population to have access to this. And that evolves and evolves and evolves to today when people, both genders, all different backgrounds, socioeconomic, racial, you know, have access to this institution. And so whereas once it was a very small portion of populations that were going to these institutions, now it's a much larger portion.
Which means that the institution is no longer serving its purpose, right? It was a way to concentrate power. So I'm the Duke of Edinburgh and, you know, Trisha's the Duchess of Yorkshire, and we send our kids to Oxford so they can mix with each other, make connections, so later when they come back, and you know, there's bridges and alliances and whatnot. So in America, this no longer makes sense. Now, and I want to just to footnote something that you said earlier, Tricia, like, like sexual assault on campus, it's not like it goes through a different process. It goes through an additional process. And that's the thing that I really, if it was different, I could be like, I don't know. I think my question would be different. The fact that we layer on top of existing societal structures this other process specifically for this, like, you know, 12 square block area in a city seems odd to me. And to Jason's point, it's no longer useful. Like, it's no longer useful. What are we going to do when the whitest and the brightest pull out of colleges altogether and they make some new thing, you know, <'cause, laughs> so that they can consolidate their power? I think a lot of what we're a lot of the problems we're seeing on campus, and here comes my cynical side, a lot of the problems we're seeing on campus lately in the news as far as, like, these fraternity racist nonsense and the sexual assault, it's sort of like it's this system showing the seams, right? These sorts of things, because of the privilege at these institutions in the past, these sorts of things can happen without anyone batting an eyelash, right? Mm-hmm. But we don't. That's not the way it works anymore. So these problems are showing us that this sequestering doesn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
The sub part I wanted to bring up is, as I was just thinking about this and riling myself up, as we talk about money, as connected to what we talked about last time about that college wrestler who, whatever, he was convicted of giving HIV out, like, so many cupcakes or whatever. But, like, why was he even in college? He could not read. They pushed him along because they were making money off of him, presumably. I don't know how college sports works. But, like, it's just
that's
one more
it
reason.
Like, yeah.
It's just one more thing. Like, why, if this is an educational institution, all of these things that we're doing, like sports, why are there sports in educational institution if that's the purpose? And why are people who can't learn or couldn't get into the institution even there, the just to play sports? I don't know. My mind begins to boggle.
And to play sports so that the institution, I mean, all the incentives. And this is what I think what we're maybe all agreeing is that I think this has to bottom out eventually, because there's just this
where
enormous arms
how,
race. Well, how is going to be economic? I mean, universities are just, they can't even stop themselves. They raise their tuition so much. They're building these enormous sports programs that do rely on this exploitation of people. And at some point, you know, it's already the case that, you know, for people, we're trying to send more and more kids to college, and yet it's more and more expensive. So you've got the wealthy, of course, who are continuing to go, and then we're constantly struggling to get more kids there, and yet these universities are building themselves on models of scale that they have to have 10, 20, 30,000 kids to afford it, but then they can't stop themselves from charging more and more. So at some point, not because of any of the things we're talking about, for moral reasons, it's going to bottom out. And I don't know what happens then, but it's just not sustainable. There's no way all of these institutions can continue to survive. And it's like they can't help themselves. They're like they're jumping off cliffs because they can't stop themselves from building more buildings and scaling up.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the first instances of this particular push to kind of maybe working themselves out of business is the scorecard idea. You know, for the first time, institutions are going to be scored based on how well their graduates are doing, based on how much money the graduates are taking out and then owe.
Oh.
Because one of the this is a big this if you Google the Obama College Scorecard, there's a lot of pushback on it. That's what this is about, because colleges and universities have been operating under the assumption that they have added value for years, and that has never been tested or challenged. Right?
Oh,
so
boy,
you know,
there's going to be a reckoning. There's going to be a reckoning.
Exactly, right? Because the question is, right? Because, you know, why would you have a business why would you have a business whose very mission is we are going to graduate people who can succeed in business or succeed in industries, and then if I go and evaluate those people, they then tell me, oh, I never went to college. the most successful never went to college, or what, or if they do go to college, they're too strapped by debt to actually see a good return on their investment. So for the first time, colleges and universities are beginning to have to answer the return on investment question. So it's coming.
It's coming. And again, I want to be clear. Like, my question was about college education. I think is definitely going to change for economic factors.
But sure.
I'm particularly concerned about this academy style learning that we're still resorting to in 2015, where you're shipping your kid off. I don't see why that's necessary. I mean, if community colleges were more of a thing, I'm a big fan of community colleges. I'm a big fan of public libraries. I'm a big fan of like these local resources of education. I don't know why we're siloing children at 17 and 18, siloing them off to fend for themselves with other people who are no wiser than them. It just makes sense. Hi, it's Chris from 2016 here. Just jumping in so the transition between my topic and Trisha's isn't that abrupt. There was some audio difficulty and I had to cut out part of the conversation. So we're going to jump right into Trisha's topic. So here it is.
So obviously you all know, if you've listened to any of these podcasts, that I'm an avid user of Twitter, and I happen to follow someone by the name of Son of Baldwin, who's a wonderful follow, and he posted a tweet, and he said, sometimes I think, it just came out of the blue, but it said, sometimes I think we hate Jaden and Willow Smith because they are free black children, and we don't know what free black children look like. And so let me just give some context to this. I mean, Will Smith and Jada Pinkett Smith's children have come up in the press for many years. And oftentimes, any sort of article about them, if you look at the comments section, is filled with sort of virulent things. And usually the kids are not doing anything off color per se. I mean, yeah, sometimes they're snotty, spoiled kids.
No, but usually they're not doing anything at all, actually.
Yeah, usually they're just
walking down the street,
I mean, maybe starring in their father's movie, something along those lines, and the reaction to them is palpable hatred, and often from people of color. And so this reaction came out of a picture of Jaden Smith walking around with a skirt, or actually I think it was from wearing a weird costume to Kim and Kanye's wedding. That tweet came about, and so I responded, and I said, you know, I think that people are really upset with their luxury, the ability that these kids have to experiment. And then he responded by saying, yes, everyone wants to beat, box, chain, imprison, and police black children. Willow and Jaden represent escape. So I just wanted to pose the question, do we have a problem in this country with freedom, with free black children? Are the free? Do they represent freedom? What do they represent that makes people get so angry?
The answer to your question is yes. What? So let's move on. No, I'm kidding. Yes. Do you have a problem with free black children? You had posed this question to me a long time ago, which was, where is the black Zooey Deschanel, right? Mm-hmm. Zooey Deschanel's entire character is about, oh, I like flowers, and I play the ukulele, and I wear my hats askew, and whatever, and, you know, I've got pigtails, and it's ironic, and that is a particular kind of white girl. That character, I mean, lately, it's not exactly a ditzy character, but it's sort of like this carefree character who goes to the beat of her own drum and is making flower crowns, et cetera, while teaching kindergarten and whatever. Not necessarily a ditzy, blonde, stupid woman, but a sort of carefree, devil may care, take life as it comes sort of person. And there is no black celebrity that I can identify, black female celebrity, that falls into that. And that was the first time I began to evaluate, like, what is it about black women that they can't hold that space? You know, we've had Asian women fill that space. We've had Hispanic women fill that space. It's sort of, I guess the word I'm looking for is a silliness. There's a silliness to these characters, and black women are never allowed to be silly. Now, in a side conversation I had with Jason, he brought up Lupita Nyong'o, who we all know for being famous and gorgeous and beautiful. And like, he thought of her as a carefree black girl. I'm talking about you, Jason, like you're not on the call. You know.
Well, wait. Can I wait? I do want to clarify. I did not call her a carefree black girl. I said the way she was photographed, and many of the articles on the web about the carefree black girl and carefree black boy are particularly about still photographs and images. Mm-hmm. And I was saying that most of the images that I've seen of her portray what I think falls into this carefree black girl. I am not saying that she's a carefree black girl. I don't pertain to know whether any black woman that I don't personally know is a carefree black girl.
We don't know these people. So, I mean, as far as their personality, I'm just talking about their representation in the media. And that's still pictures, yes, but it's also like the kinds of questions they're asked in interviews. Who interviews them? On what topics? Like those sorts of things. And I feel like Lupita, while all of her photographs are in like these flowy, gorgeous gowns or whatever, there's something very serious about Lupita's ascension, about her Oscar win. There's something very serious. And she would not get asked the same questions that Zooey Deschanel would. I mean, clearly
not at all.
They're doing different kinds of art.
Sure.
Right. They're doing different kinds of art, sure. Yes. But my point is that I can't really think of a black celebrity who would.
This really struck me when I was in a sociology class, and they were talking about child rearing. Obviously, Chris and I have talked about this maybe a few times in the past about how we were reared by our parents and how we were sort of really trained about how to go about the world, because the world for our parents was a dangerous place for us as black children. And so you are taught that you have to sort of inhabit it very differently from your white friends, even if you live in white neighborhoods, right? So you can't run into a store and play with this thing and run out of the store. They're just going to assume that you're stealing. From the very beginning, there's a lack of whimsy and play.
Yes.
That is allowed. Yeah, there's a lack of whimsy and play that is associated with black children. And now, you know, we happen to be filming this podcast at the same time as the McKinney, Texas event, where these black children were invited by their white friends to a pool party, and their neighbors called the cops because there were too many black children around. And then when the cops came, the reaction to these black children who were in bikinis, so you can't say that they might have been hiding weapons, were extreme. And the assumption is that these children, 15-year-old and less, were somehow dangerous. And so I really believe that's all connected. That's why you cannot find your Zooey Deschanel. I mean, and the only way that you can find them is among that black intelligentsia. Will Smith's money and access to certain experiences give his children the freedom to walk around in a skirt.
So is that the answer then? Are we back to economics?
It's economics.
If black people did better economically, could we see sillier black girls?
Yes, because the threat of economic ascension, right? Because the idea is that you have to buckle down. You have to be serious, because if you don't if you don't make the right choices, your life could be messed up. But if your parents have a firm economic base, if they have wealth, your options are just so much, there's so many more options available to you. You can experiment. You can be silly. To answer your question about who's the black Zooey Deschanel, the answers to those questions have been Whitmacaulay's children. He's a singer, Lisa Bonet's children. Lenny Kravitz's daughter, who also hangs out with Zooey Kravitz. There's a kind of whimsy to her, which, if you remember, Lisa Bonet had that quality, and she also generated very violent reactions from the black community as well. She did. And there was a lot of violent reactions to her in particular once she moved down that road. We all remember when she started growing out her hair, putting rings in her nose. There were a lot of things that happened.
I think they said even Felicia Rashad hated her, I think, on the set or something.
Exactly. because the idea is we've always been presented as you've got to buck up as black people. You got to buck up, you got to put on a suit and tie, and you got to get out there and do
and
the world a certain way.
And there's a seriousness to it.
Yes.
And I want to just say this out loud. I'm not saying there's a value to Zooey Deschanel. Sorry.
No.
I'm not saying there's a value to silliness in and of itself. What I'm reacting to is the fact that we do not allow black children to choose whimsy as a goal. Like, regardless of whether that's valuable or not, the road's just closed. Like, if you want to be sort of a hippie art teacher, great, that's out of the way. Like, you're not going to do that. You know, you want to learn how to play the piccolo or the ukulele or whatever? No, there's no time for that. And I think that's really problematic because, and I'm trying to connect the Texas event to this, right? Because I don't see the connection as quickly as you do, Tricia. But I think it's because there's something about Black children having fun that seems really alien because we just don't see it. Maybe if there was more Black whimsy, something like Texas wouldn't have happened because Black children splashing around in a pool and having a good time would not seem threatening. It wouldn't seem so unusual.
And strangely enough that you say that, because I retweeted this on this image on my timeline, and it's from the 1960s. There's a man that comes along, an old white man comes along, and there are two Black children splashing in a pool, and he takes a bottle of bleach and pours it over them. So, again, I'm just saying it's this idea that there's something...
I don't know what that is. I don't know how that connects. Batman.
But you know what? Don't play in my pool. What is this idea that these children are dirty? These children are off. There's something wrong with them. They are animal-like. They don't... So, you know, I mean, that's the connection for me. The connection is there's no innocence presumed. Black children are not presumed to have innocence. And the Zooey Deschanel element, the carefree element, there's an innocence to it. Because, you know, let me just say, because I went and did some research, it's the innocence, because it says it's a direct and public rebuttal of traditional stereotypes and caricatures of Black women as constantly angry, unusually aggressive, and always strong. So it's also even useful to use the word girl. I mean, girl, which is weird, right? Because if you call a white woman girl, they'd be very offended. But in a strange way, when you call when a Black woman chooses to say she's a girl, she's choosing to kind of connect to the childness, the playful child in herself, because we just don't see that. Terms like gamine or any of those kind of light words that are associated with somebody like an Audrey Hepburn, you never get those associated to Black women. Pixie.
The other thing Pixie, that's a good one. Also, Jason, I've talked too much. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I don't think I totally agree with what you two are saying. I agree to an extent, but I think we're conflating a few things. So first of all,
for sure.
Sure.
You know, I think looking at how these celebrities are presenting themselves and connecting that or comparing that with how the vast majority of Black children and Black families operate, you know, who are not celebrities. I don't know. It's a little dicey to me. I think what I'm about to say is a generalization, but I feel a little more comfortable with this generalization than the ones that I hear you two making, which is that I feel like I've known lots of Black children and lots of Black families that do allow a lot of whimsy. I think that at either end of the economic spectrum, I think you'd find a lot of that. I think that what you two are describing is your experience growing up, and certainly the experience of many other Black children, is really families that are committed to or trying very hard to achieve social mobility. And I just think, like...
That's kind of the point, though.
I do want to point out, though, that, like, there are lots of Black kids that splash around in pools and hang out and are more or less carefree, that, and they're not all wealthy.
For how long? I mean, we're not saying that kids don't do it. This is not what we're saying.
We're saying kids don't play.
Yeah, we're not saying kids don't play.
There is a point that where, I'm sorry, Trisha, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Jason, I think, I won't speak for Trisha, I'll speak for me. I think what I'm saying is that there is a point when we tell Black children a different story about their play, about the way that it has to happen. And I think society also supports that and tells them the story. You know, I've been reflecting on this because I saw some internet meme about Tiana from Princess and the Frog Princess, whatever that Disney movie was.
Yeah,
and
Princess and the Frog.
The idea that, you know, it's the first Black Disney princess. And you know what I recalled? And also I remember this when you brought up Lupita. You know, we don't often tell Black girls that they're princesses. Usually we tell Black children they're kings and queens. I remember hearing that a lot when I was little. You're a queen. Your mother's a queen. Like, your lady is your queen. Like, there's something always so serious about Black women. It's something that they're taught to carry around with them. Now, I'm not saying that little Black people, like children, do not play. What I'm saying is that a true equality will come when all children can choose their destiny, right? And if that destiny is that I want to be a hippy-dippy art teacher, or I want to do this thing which is off the beaten path, it's not going to look weird. It looks weird in black people. You know, I remember Trisha once saying to me a long time ago that if there was a character on TV, if there was a New Girl show starring a black person instead of Zooey Deschanel, a lot of the jokes and humor would be that this person is in some way mentally deficient. Right, it wouldn't hold. It would look really, really odd, and that's problematic.
I want to say two things, which is one, I don't totally agree about is like the issue in Dallas. I don't know all the details. I watched the video, but the issue there, and there we know there's a whole history of public pools and the way black people are treated in public pools and that kind of thing. But I don't know. I really don't think those are primarily about white people feeling threatened by black children having fun. They're threatened by black children being in their pool or in their neighborhood.
But that's the point, Jason. They're threatened by black children. Why are you threatened by children? Who is threatened by children? What is the assumption about the child?
I agree. I just think it's – I don't see it as the same thing. I think it's conflating that with the carefree. I just think they're –
I think that I see the connection, Jason. Like, it is connected because one is feeding into the other in a loop. By the way, I just want to say for the record, this was the light topic.
Okay. Yeah.
So.
But it.
I want to say one other thing, which is just there's a great children's book series called I Am Truly, and it's a little black girl's name is Truly. I read these books to my kids, and one of them is called Princess Truly and the Hungry Bunny Problem. It's a great book.
Trisha, take us home on this.
I think the presumption, I think I remember an interview that I did recently with a very well-known scholar or lawyer, Mr. Stevenson, that in terms
yeah,
of...
Stevenson, yeah.
Yes. And I think that was his point. He says the presumption of otherness and the vilification of that otherness is at the core of this sort of this carefree black rebuttal, which is let's take everything that we assume about the word carefree and add the opposite to that, and that is the label that most black children exist under. Whether they know they exist under it, their parents know they exist under it. And their parents construct a universe for their kids, maybe to their own detriment. Maybe it's the parents, you know, and in some ways that's actually the critique of the Smiths from many older black people is you guys are creating an image of the world for these children that does not exist. They will be rudely awakened. That's really, I think, on some level, a big part of that discussion for them is that you're doing these kids wrong. They can't be this free. And at some point in time, they're going to recognize their cage. And so,
That's dark.
You know, I just, you know, I raise the issue because I think sometimes we do internalize our own, I mean, we internalize the system and structures, and here we have ended up back to the space that we started with Jason's scenario, which is why I think in many ways maybe it was so hard for us to go and live in that space, really, because we knew we could never live outside of the system. So we couldn't even go with the the thought experiment too far.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, now that we're talking, I think we are conflating a lot of things.
Yes.
I see the connection, but I think we're just taking nibbles off of, like, we're taking
big
nibbles
things.
Off of, like, three very big topics. And so maybe we're making, like, a weird salad. But, I mean, I see how these things are intimately connected. It's Chris from the future again. Remember, this was recorded in the summer of 2015. So when you hear our recommendations, it's not that we're hopelessly behind the times. We were on the cutting edge of what was important back then.
Yeah,
so
I'm ready.
Here we go.
And there's a bit of a segue because I'm going to mention Zoe Kravitz. So I went last night to see Mad Max Fury Road. I was not dying to see it, but I kind of was like, I feel like going to a movie, and I looked at all the movies out, and it was the only one that I even felt like it was worth me spending some money on. And first of all, Zoe Kravitz is in it and is not carefree at all in it, but I realized she was acting. I think I've seen her in two movies now, and both movies she was very intense, but I know, unfortunately, that's not how she always is, but she was very intense in this movie, and the movie was very intense. The movie, I feel like it started out, I was very uncomfortable in it at first, and then as it went on, I liked it more and more, and it's, again, like, it's not, I'm not really terribly into the post-apocalyptic kind of genre, but, it was a good movie. I'm still, it's like, the images are still in my head. Like, I'm still, like, wrangling with it. It was good.
Do Do you know they got Eve Ensler to consult on that movie?
Wait, they got what?
Eve Ensler. She wrote the Vagina Monologues. They got her to consult on the movie because as a feminist or something. I haven't seen the movie, and I don't know what it's about. I thought maybe that would make sense to you.
Yeah, no, it does. It does. I mean, I still find it surprising, but yeah, I mean, there's definitely a feminist streak in it.
Interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. Huh, Trisha?
Well, this is pretty heavy, but I'm sorry, but I happened to watch it. Sorry, I really liked it. I watched the documentary Southern Rights, which is on HBO right now. And it actually, the documentarian went there to cover the first integrated prom in one of these southern cities where that people were having separate proms. And then another story emerged that captured her imagination, and she followed that story. And so it was just a really fascinating look at a part of the country we only contemplate when we have to vote for folks. So it was a really, really good documentary. And John Legend is the producer of it. And so, it's called Southern Rights. It's really good, really interesting. And if you see it on HBO, and it's on HBO On Demand, but it also probably is online somewhere, I'd recommend checking it out. We might be able to use that to have the conversation that we just finished to flesh it out even more.
I'm just going to go for the obvious bit because there's no way that three intelligent people are going to have a conversation this week and not talk about Caitlyn Jenner. So, it's on my mind only because I wouldn't say.
Oh, we had gone so long without talking about Caitlyn.
I know, but it's been 1 hour, so someone has to say the words Caitlyn and Jenner. I made a pact to myself that when Caitlyn Jenner revealed herself on the cover of Vanity Fair, anyone who said anything stupid would be immediately unfriended on Facebook. Like, so I just don't want to deal with it. Say what you want about, you know, not, like, shutting down alternate opinions. Well, I just, Facebook is my recreational thing. I don't need to be assaulted by nonsense.
How'd it go?
And, well, my cousin posted something.
Oh, yes.
Trisha's friends with a lot of my family on Facebook. My cousin posted something very controversial. We got into it on Facebook in public, which I swear not to do. And then we had an offline conversation, and everything's fine now. But the one thing that I encouraged her to do to refine her opinions is to really read up on Caitlyn Jenner and her struggle, which is something that I did a little bit today. And I would suggest, you know, as we talk a lot about trans issues, the majority of Americans do not know a trans person. So maybe it's not intuitive what that struggle might look like. So I'm not recommending anything in particular. Caitlyn Jenner's story is just as good. You know, I mean, I say go to the classics, like Sylvia Rivera, like learn about these trans women and really try to understand what that struggle looks like. It's not something that cisgendered people can sort of claim. Even as a gay person myself, like I have my own struggle, but my struggle with society wasn't with my own body. And I don't know what that would be like. And I don't know if that's the media recommendation other than, you know, compassion's always a good default. And you can get compassion, really, through study. You got to read other people's accounts of their lives.
Great point.
Present day Chris here. I hope you enjoyed that trip down memory lane. Join us next week when Trisha and Jason return and we discuss other outrageous topics. Take care. Thanks. Bye.